Good afternoon and welcome to the first of two August meetings of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine. A particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum since 1983. This is our 31st year. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen or journalists, talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker Associate Professor Michelle Egan. She's also the Jean Monnet Chair in the School of International Service at the American University in Washington, the author of a number of books, including Single Markets, Economic Integration in Europe and the United States, which will be published by the Oxford University Press in December. She's been the recipient of a number of fellowships and awards, including a Bosch Fellowship and German Marshall Fellowship, and been a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington. She is currently working on a book on the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, as well as articles on the European Court of Justice. She is an EU citizen with British and Irish citizenship. So we're delighted to have Michelle with us today. Her topic is the EU and its relationship to the United States. So a warm welcome to Michelle.
Thank you very much for the invite to this very high-profile foreign policy expert forum, which focuses on American strategic interests around the globe. I'll put my hat on and say to you, I'm here as a European. So my perspective may be that slightly different than those who project US foreign policy. I'm delighted to be here, and what I'm gonna do today in talking to you is I'm gonna start off with a very sort of broad analysis of the transatlantic relationship. And then, because I'm from Europe, I'm gonna talk to you a little bit about some of the current internal dynamics and tensions within Europe. And then thirdly, some of the important political, economic, and security issues that are of key concern to both European and US foreign policy makers. And so I think it's important to remember as we're here is that the EU, as it shows, is composed of member states or nation states. So on the one hand, the United States foreign policy engages increasingly with the EU, and it engages with Europe on two levels. On the one hand, with the EU as a political and economic entity of 28 states in areas of sanctions against Russia, global economic management, trade agreements, and nuclear negotiations over Iran's future program. And on the other hand, on specific issues, Washington, if it doesn't like the EU position, it can and it does directly work with individual nation states. Perhaps less in trade, but it certainly is willing to do so in other areas. And so European policy and foreign policy is by its very nature difficult to coordinate. Each member state has its own historical footprint, you know, its own bilateral ties, its own history. And so we look in the United States to Germany in relation to Russia, or we look to France in relation to Mali. And so so a lot of our discussion of the transatlantic relationship between the US and the EU, it tends to sort of go back and talk about the Cold War, the history, Kennedy, and so forth. And we often have write books, I do myself, about Atlantic drift, the estranged partnership, how to recast it, and so forth. But my focus is more the contemporary. And I want to take a look a little bit about transatlantic relations under Obama and his predecessors. And so we've had one full Obama administration, and a lot of people feel that it has largely overcome the tensions that we had found in the Bush administration. So we're happy, you know, with the, you know, for Europeans, they're happy with sort of the transformation in terms of the Bush, from Bush to Obama. And they're also very happy with what they see as an Atlanticist, John Kerry, Secretary of State, Chuck Hagel as Secretary of Defense, who was at the Atlantic Council when I was there, and Anthony Gardner, who came from the NSC to be the new EU ambassador. And so, having withdrawn from Iraq, moved towards a smaller US and NATO presence in Afghanistan, accelerated a pivot to Asia, Obama, Biden, Kerry, and before her departure, Clinton, took a lot of pains to stress the importance of Europe as a global partner. Even though the BRICS and the rise of China now attract Washington's attention with multiple impasses in response to regional conflict, it's very much reminded the administration with Russia, with NATO, with Afghanistan, with Iran, that Europe is by far the most reliable source of support for US goals. And so, do not be mistaken. We, you know, beyond our economic ties, our foreign and security policy, Europe and the EU have close cooperation on counterterrorism, energy policy, and many other issues. Despite those positives, there are irritants in that relationship, including climate policy, data privacy, and the European request to close Guantanamo Bay. So, though Congress has generally focused a limited role in foreign relations, it's pushed the EU back a little bit on Iranian sanctions and on airline emissions. So, the first point I want to make is the advantages and challenges of moving beyond not Bush. That's how Europeans see it. They welcomed Obama's 2008 victory, and he received a lot of credit in Europe for simply being not Bush, and espousing at the very beginning this multilateral, consultative approach to international policy. But I think it's largely overlooked the fact that the second Bush administration really went out of their way to have a rapprochement with the transatlantic relationship. Secretary of State Rice was very clear in pushing Bush to Europe in 2005 and talking about US needs Europe as a global partner. So what happens is Obama seemed to promote this more internationalist approach, but he also said that he would reserve the right to act unilaterally if necessary to defend my nation. In this regard, Obama was reviving the Clinton mantra, together when possible, alone when necessary. So despite their very different receptions from Europe, I think Obama initially pursued transatlantic relations in a manner quite similar to George W. Bush in his second term of office. And both Bush and Obama share a distinct lack of love at first sight for European leaders when they have to meet them in the EU European Council. Bush was harangued in Stockholm, and Obama could not believe that the Europeans used their time for all 28 of them at the table to say something to him. What a waste when you have the President of the United States in the room. So from the outset, the Obama administration has echoed a number of themes common to all US administrations, namely dissatisfaction with European contributions to NATO, particularly its efforts in Afghanistan. This theme of burden sharing, though, it's been constant through the transatlantic relationship. Ask Senator Mike Mansfield from the 60s, and he had the same message. But Gates did warn them about the decline of European capabilities as he left, and his departing words, Robert Gates, to his NATO colleagues. He said, you know, be careful. If you do not do this, future US policy and political leaders, those for whom the Cold War was not their formative experience that it was for me, Robert Gates, may or may not consider the American investment in NATO worth the cost. In light of current events, Europeans will not increase their military spending. Only four NATO members, Britain, France, Italy, and Greece, spend at the level that NATO and the US expects. Nonetheless, this ambiguous post-Cold War role that NATO has, limited success in Afghanistan, failed defense, falling defense spending, growing insularity bred out of a financial crisis on both sides of the Atlantic, and a real sense that an absence of clear and present dangers contributed to a sense that NATO was passing into irrelevance. But events change things. And right now, it will be David Cameron in Wales in September that will not be focusing on NATO's role in withdrawal from Afghanistan. They will be focusing on a decisive response to Russian actions in Ukraine. And they will be certainly providing reassurance about the collective defense of its members in Europe. And so a lot of people have said, you know, this is a stark reminder of NATO's responsibilities in Europe and the limited role and reach of the EU. And so, yes and no. Europeans, you know, in terms of limited, we've got our attention back again about the relevance of NATO, but that should not underestimate the relevance and centrality of the EU to the European and transatlantic relationship. Bear in mind, how does Europe see the United States? Europeans were very disappointed. The US canceled its last summit with the EU in 2010. It's only this year, in the context of the crisis with Crimea and Russia, that the EU and US had a summit in Brussels. It's taken 4 years. And so European disappointment is very much in Obama's policies, but I think it's a misreading by Europeans of his fundamental approach to international affairs. He's very much viewed as instrumental and unsentimental in his views on Europe and other potential partners. And so in terms of for Europeans, most argue that Europeans would be better served by getting their act together. And getting your act together in a time of crisis isn't easy. The 1970s, when US monetary policy was in disarray, Middle East shocks, it was very instructive for the idea that Europeans have to come together today. So much has been made of the European weakness and weak economic recovery, but it's precisely the strength of Europe as an economic powerhouse and the interconnectedness of the European and American economy that makes it so important for the United States. There is a reason that the Treasury Secretary called Europe 56 times during the current economic crisis. And so there's a reason that it really mattered when Obama was up for re-election about the state of the European economy. As a result of that, Europeans and Americans have launched what some believe will be the largest free trade agreement in the last year, a transatlantic trade and investment partnership. But Europeans are concerned mostly about the Obama pivot towards Asia, both in the security realm, where they've added their defense towards the South China Sea, and they're also concerned with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement that the US is conducting with Asian states. That, for them, appears to raise a tremendous concern in this transatlantic relationship. But, you know, history. You all remember your history in this room. Obama's pivot is reminiscent of other administrations' turn to the outside. Nixon's overture to China in the 70s, Clinton's involvement in NATO and APEC, and George W. Bush's first-term willingness to look anywhere but Europe. In all cases, the transatlantic relationship was not adrift. The Americans were simply looking to protect their interest everywhere. But, you know, Europeans continue to fear, even though Americans reassure them, that Asia is the region of the future. The trade numbers tell us that, you know. EU-Asia trade, US-Asia trade is really starting to now exceed US-EU trade. Some of them would disagree and say no. The US-EU economic relationship is still very important in trades, goods, and services. That's why we have agreement. And so from that point of view, you know, Europeans continue to fear that, you know, fear has been part of this transatlantic relationship for a long time. Fear of Japanese economic advances in the 70s prompted Europeans to create a single market, and it encouraged the Americans to create a transatlantic declaration. And of course, fear of the Soviet Union and created the Atlantic Alliance in the first place. So while the sort of from the outside, there may be the seeds of transatlantic strife, the history of the transatlantic relationship demonstrates that it can lead to closer cooperation. And so with that sort of as a sort of broad stroke, why does this matter? And, you know, on the one hand, there are often people who are concerned about the transatlantic relationship, its drift, its future, and so forth, and the American willingness to look elsewhere. And how reliable is an EU of 28 to speak with a single voice? They know that. They're very aware of that. Lady Ashton, when she's in town, always tells the famous story that somebody went into the Obama White House and said, Europeans now have a European foreign policy. And they said, oh, what's the telephone number? Kissinger always wanted that one telephone number. And so they make that phone call to Europe, and it says, you know, for the German position, press 1. For the French position, press 2. And we know that in Europe. We're fully aware of that. But one of the things that I want Americans to appreciate is to think about the internal tensions and dynamics within Europe. If you ask us to step up to the plate, think about what we're dealing with within Europe right now. And sometimes Europe looks inward-looking. It looks like it's focusing on who's going to be the next head and the bargaining, the horse trading over appointments, or we're focused on these strange institutions in Brussels. Yes, we are. But, you know, the EU is a source of a tremendous frustration with numerous competing interests and a very opaque legislative and regulatory process from the outside. But there are tons of issues on the European agenda that the Americans may not be able to influence, but I can tell you that the National Security Council, the SEC, the State Department, the Treasury, among others, really, really follow very closely. And to give you some sense of those, I want to highlight a few so perhaps you'll have a little sympathy about why we have multiple telephone numbers. The first one, at the top of the agenda is the European economy. It's a crisis of institutional design, how we design the euro. It's a fiscal crisis. It's a crisis of competitiveness. It's a banking crisis. In Europe, austerity is being pursued. It remains disappointing. We won't see average growth in the eurozone this year beyond 1%. And our investment has fallen 18% in the last 6 years compared to your 6. And so Southern Europe investment has literally collapsed. Even in Britain, my home country, we're now back at pre-crisis levels. Inequality is increasing and wages are anemic. And so the EU, we've gradually learned that during the crisis, the EU took a long time to act decisively. And compared to the United States as of today, excessive debt is hard to work off. Our public debt remains high, and our credit is tight, and our bank liabilities are enormous. For those who have suffered from the euro crisis, the youngest generations have been hardest hit, and they voted en masse for left-leaning, anti-austerity parties across Europe. To give you some idea, unemployment among youth is 56% in Greece. Unemployment among in Italy is 43% amongst youth. The second issue is immigration and border issues. You're all focused on Mexico, but illicit immigration from North Africa and the Middle East has surged in Europe. We have vast land and sea borders. It's a task far greater than has faced the United States along its border with Mexico. As our borders are shifting, as we enlarge the EU, we've also expanded EU policy in asylum, immigration, internal security. We've created Europol and Eurojust. We even have a European-wide extradition warrant. We can extradite people across borders. That's a tremendous impact on state sovereignty. And we really care about this issue. Domestically, we're concerned. People are voting for radical right parties. If you live in Denmark, if you live in Britain, if you live in France, those parties recently got 20 to 25% of the general vote in European parliamentary elections. I'm not saying it's a European phenomena, but the immigration issue is not exclusive to the United States. The third issue is backsliding of democracy. We were so euphoric with the collapse of communism. There's a rise of illiberalism, growing concerns about democracy and freedom of speech, and corruption in European states. If I asked you what country, I don't know what you would give me, but right now it is Hungary is the center of EU attention. We have to at some point deal with the Hungarian constitutional crisis. We will probably put sanctions on Hungary, but it is also followed by Bulgaria, Romania, and others. And we want that to be an EU issue, not a Council of Europe where Putin could actually have a role and a say. And the last issue is secession pressures, referendums, and the implication for the EU. Scotland, Catalonia, pressures for independence. They don't want simply devolution and more power. They really want to talk about identity. They want to talk about new constitutional questions, party politics. They want public policy issues dealt with in Catalonia, in Scotland. And so these are primarily domestic issues, but they have constitutional implications for the EU. Because how will we deal with currency, defense, and EU membership? Will they be a new member or will they have to apply? Most people in the United States would say, it doesn't matter, it's just a new flag, like your Finnish flag or your Swiss flag. It's just a new set of institutions. We've got 28, why not take 30, 35? But the implications of the UK, which is talking about withdrawal from the EU and is talking about a referendum in 2017, keeping the Britain in Europe is contentious, it is difficult, and it is something that the US has actually articulated as a concern. Deputy Assistant Secretary for State for Europe, Phil Gordon, made a rare intervention in London, and he said, we want to see a British voice in that European Union. That is in the American interest. And the press went crazy. Mind your own business. Stay out of this. But it's very reminiscent of the 60s. We wanted in the United States, Britain in the EU as a counterweight to France. And so it's also important for economic interests. Businesses have also indicated if Britain exits from the EU, certain businesses will exit the EU, particularly in the financial sector. All of these things are just to give you a flavor for the challenges Europe faces internally. So asking us to have a transatlantic relationship, asking us to spend more on defense, asking us to speak with a collective voice, I think we've often forgotten that the optimistic narratives of the EU, you know, the new superpower, are now in retreat. The Europe is faced with agonizing dilemmas about its conflict in its eastern borders. It's agonizing conflict about enlargement towards the Balkans, its own internal democracy with radical right, and about the future of the European project. So from an American foreign policy standpoint, my third issue would be, so what's on our agenda? What can we do with those internally squabbling, divided Europeans? It remains an indispensable ally, a key strategic partner in foreign and foreign economic policy. And so the era of transatlantic relations as bilateral is past. The demands in Afghanistan, the Horn of Africa, Iran, all have contributed to a globalization of transatlantic strategy. Much has been made of that pivot to Asia, the rebalancing vis-a-vis Asia. But from Iran to Mali, Europe is the likely partner in terms of crisis management. So there are three key issues for both sides, which are probably evident to many of you in this room and those listening on the radio, but it's perhaps worth bearing them in mind given this comment. The recent US ambassador, Anthony Gardner, to the EU is just a marvelous appointment for Europeans. He has a long pedigree in European affairs, and he made two comments when he arrived in Brussels, which I hope you will take with you. He was at the National Security Council 20 years ago. And when he said he arrived, he said, "I think I'm going to work on the EU." And he was told, "That's great, because no one here cares about that stuff." 20 years on, we do. And then he called the Treasury, and he asked about the US position on the planned common currency, the Eurozone. And he was told, "We don't need a position. It will never happen." So I think he got in early understanding the complexities of the EU. And so the breadth of issues involving the EU is something I mentioned last night. It's expanded dramatically. Many years ago, people thought about the EU in terms of trade and finance. And the strategic relevance of the EU now has increased in a range of policy areas. It's no longer just the State Department with its counterparts in the EU. It's cooperation on everything from terrorist financing to mutual extradition to agricultural issues to trade issues. We see as many people in the Department of Agriculture, in the Treasury, with interlocutors in Europe as we do in terms of the State Department. Our public diplomacy with the EU is very, very varied and very, very much part of the American political, regulatory, economic system. But there are three issues that will dominate discussions in the near term. The first one is TTIP. I don't know who gave it such a terrible, I'm British, so TTIP just doesn't sound right. The first issue is TTIP, the failure of the Doha round after a decade of negotiations to reach any global trade agreement has led to the proliferation of what I would call mega regional free trade agreements. And so with the sovereign debt crisis in Europe and a sluggish economy, and we had this weakening of transatlantic trade and investment, the real issue was to promote a transatlantic marketplace. And so the idea was to launch a trade and investment agreement that would be the largest in the globe. And you could do that without having a tremendous limited budgetary impact. Let's go for trade liberalization. And it's interesting because it's a real change for Europeans. Europeans and Americans were involved in competitive liberalization, a free trade agreement with Korea. Oh, we'll have one next. Free trade agreement with Singapore. We'll have one next. Now it's a bilateral one covering a lot of issues. But most people think, well, it's just about liberalization between Europe and the United States. No, it's not. It's really about how can we shape the global market in state-owned enterprises, investment, intellectual property. How can we as two players set the global rules given Doha? This economic partnership has been called an economic NATO. So some people originally assumed it was designed to deal with the rapid rise of China. It's no longer simply an economic relationship, but it's become, in light of recent events, a political project to strengthen ties. There is support from business on both sides. There will be contentious issues, agriculture, financial services are not included. There will be issues of data privacy. There will be a tremendous amount of friction. Even the AFL-CIO, which historically is not fond of trade deals, really likes this one and has come out in favor because the fact it will not put downward pressure on wages on US workers. There's a business coalition, but there's growing mobilization of opposition, which I expect, because around most trade deals post-NAFTA, there will be opposition. Politically, the United States doesn't have trade promotion authority from Congress. It's hard to make negotiating offers when you don't. Progress is being made, but if you have a US midterm election in late 2014, and then the presidential cycle kicks in, we might not see a successful conclusion of this trade deal for quite some years. And we also have to watch. Americans are very focused on what their negotiating position is. Please pay attention to a new European Parliament that is asking questions about data privacy and is asking questions about a whole variety of American practices. Perhaps Maine is going to actually be impacted here as well, significantly in terms of agriculture and public procurement. So geopolitically, everybody is doing this. Pacific, Asia, TPP, RCEP, all these anachronisms of trade agreements. And so that's the first issue. The only one that's not part of a trade agreement of this ilk is Russia. So Russia is now being marginalized. The second issue is data privacy, surveillance and privacy. And my third very brief issue will be Russia and Ukraine. We need to overcome a current impasse in data privacy. And this has caused a lot of deep suspicions in Europe. I realize some of you are from the intelligence services here, but there have been really suspicions in Europe about American motives, especially given the Snowden files. Germans are hypersensitive about the subject. They have a parliamentary committee with an ongoing investigation of the NSA affair. There are references to the experience of the Nazis as well as East German secret police. That's pervasive. Amid this current crisis, we'll be marking the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And yet there's mistrust and anger in Germany because a lot of those infrastructures of surveillance in place during the Cold War remain in place. The United States can't ignore the reaction in Europe. Perhaps it's different histories and legacies of privacy. The responses for Europeans from Washington matter. Obama was critiqued in Europe for his Bozar speech. How a speech gets called Bozar, it's actually a speech of Bozat. But, you know, the Americans were very concerned. He never made barely a reference to this issue, and for Europeans, this was disappointing. Last week, McDonough, the chief of staff, was sent to Berlin. I think this is window dressing, but the issue will not go away. And I think there is a much more pragmatism in the United States, but an initial misunderstanding of how upset Europeans were. Be careful. Be very careful that you don't underestimate it, because that European Parliament is going to legislate on data privacy, and it will have commercial and other impacts. That European Parliament really likes the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, which includes a right to privacy. So be very careful that you do not underestimate the power of the European Parliament for your trade deal. And in 2 minutes, sanctions in response to Russia actions to Ukraine. They've cooperated closely on sanctions in response to the occupation of Crimea and the separatists in Ukraine. And we have seen an upping of broader sanctions on Russian finance, arms, and sensitive technology and energy. As usual, the EU decision-making process has not moved as quickly as many in Washington and particularly in Congress would like. And there were exceptions made to address the particularities of specific European member states. I believe the Wall Street Journal wrote that these exceptions were big enough to drive a warship through in reference to the French Mistral sale. But the energy sectors do target Russian oil, equipment, financing. They don't include gas exports. But it's also, I think, important to remember that just how much the impact of these tough economic sanctions have on Europe relative to the United States. And, you know, the trade relationship is 10 times as large for the Europeans as it is for the United States. So these sanctions will really bite in terms of Europe. And so I say that because it is an indication that Europe is finally getting its act together. It is an indication that, there is something fledgling called a European foreign policy, but the other issue is to really understand the complexities of collective action of European foreign policy. So I leave you with a thought. What kind of international system does the United States want in 2030? If its influence is in decline, it's a source of debate amongst leading thinkers, and you heard from Mersheimer and others. But the recent National Intelligence Council came out with a 2030 report. To conclude, Europe remains a key partner in maintaining liberal, internationalist institutions and values. A difficult partner, a problematic partner, but one that really is a strategic partner. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. That was great. Now let me start with some of the questions. First one, do you accept Paul Krugman's position that Europe's focus on austerity has killed the possibility of recovery?
The first one is, I'm a closet historian, so the book that I'm writing is also about 19th century America. And what were we supposed to do? Let Greece default. If we go back to the 1840s in the United States, anybody here from Pennsylvania knows that their states defaulted and their credit from Britain dried up. So on the one hand, we couldn't let a sovereign state default. Secondly, austerity. There are many who believed this was a German-driven issue, that other states, particularly France, wanted a measure of industrial policy, promotion of economic growth. So there were deep disagreements in the EU. And so that's why the EU's efforts to stem the tide is called the Growth and Stability Pact. So it needs growth and stability of the euro. I will say this in terms of austerity, that the issue really depends on where you are in Europe. If you're in Southern Europe, austerity bites, given the high levels of youth unemployment. But how many of you are familiar, I'm going to sound like a non-European here, how many of you are familiar with some of the welfare reforms that are being done in Greece? It is a cutback in Greece, you're allowed unemployment benefit assistance for 13 months. I don't know any calendar that actually gives, that has a 13 month. Some of the issues that we're cutting back in terms of welfare are, a lot of people were getting welfare after working 25 years for the French railroads. That may have been 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago when that was backbreaking work. When you're going on a TGV and you can retire in your 40s now, it's a very different story. So I think some of the welfare issues have been designed to address, what we might call abuses is a too strong a word. We do need to address some of this. We do need to put credit back in the South. We do have seen a lot of austerity, but make no mistake, those states now in Southern Europe due to legal judgments, due to what has happened about being bailed out by the IMF and the EU, are now subject to public surveillance of their budgets. So when that is a huge, you know, you imagine doing that in the United States, giving up your budget scrutiny to NAFTA or some other issue. I will tell you this, though. They look at Washington and they look in wonder, how can a great power be consumed by political polarization and gridlock? And when they look at their euro crisis, they watch the self-inflicted US debt ceiling and fiscal cliff standoffs in recent years with disbelief. And they always ask the question, why would you choose to have such a crisis? You know, that would be my response. So I would say austerity, it depends on where you are.
How does the U.S. feel, how does the EU feel about the U.S. becoming less interested in being the world's policeman? As a sort of follow-up question, is that what the EU thinks?
I do think there was initial concern about the strategic pivot, but we've heard this before. We've heard this, and you know, the U.S. plays a global role. We would argue in some ways that the EU plays a regional role. If you're going to play a role, Europe's role should really be in dealing with the influx of immigration from North Africa, Middle East, after Arab Spring, and its real role should be the Balkans. If it can't solve the Balkans in terms of, you know, given the war in the 1990s, you know, Europe needs to get its act together in its own backyard. So I do not think that it is necessarily, you know, America plays that global role. Europeans will play a supporting role, and Europeans do. One of the most interesting things is America and the US and Washington does appreciate some of the small global missions, foreign policy missions that the US does, sometimes in places the US does not want to be, particularly in regard to Africa, and particularly sort of historic ties. So, you know, they do appreciate, even if it is police, you know, election monitoring or a police mission in Bosnia, it still matters.
Okay, this relates to the last point you were talking about, which is Russia and the Ukraine. I'll preface this. Does the EU believe that Russia is going to actually invade the eastern part of the Ukraine? Or do they think their interest is primarily in simply destabilizing it? Were Russia to invade, what would the EU do? How would NATO respond?
The three answers. How many of us remember 2008, the Georgia crisis? I think in some ways the response to this crisis has been a lot stronger than the response that we had in 2008, and it was followed by the reset policy of Obama. So I think the crisis has been the response from the US and the EU this time has been much, much stronger. The second comment that I would raise is that this has made the NATO summit in September much more significant. You know, people had talked about the irrelevance of NATO going out of area, searching for a role. This has really brought that issue back to the table. But Europeans and Americans are fully aware of defense limitations. Europe has a credibility expectations gap. We expect it to do a lot, but in terms of its defense structure, its intelligence, and so forth, it doesn't have the same role that the United States does. It relied on the United States for cover in Libya. So this is not a new issue. What will happen is that, look at the House of Commons report this week. Quite startling. The House of Commons sort of said, NATO is in trouble. NATO needs to think about different kinds of capabilities. Cyber needs to think about, you know, unusual warfare given sort of small groups of separatists in the Ukraine. It also recommended, and this is the British position, not the EU, the placement of troops in the Baltics, which I was astonished by, but to have increase of NATO exercises, I think those things coming out of the House of Commons are a good bellwether for thinking in Europe. So from those point of view, I think they're very concerned. But one of the things Europeans would say is a lot of the instability is also caused by Russia. Look at Transnistria, look at Chechnya, and everywhere else. For the Europeans, where have they made their outreach? What they've done is signed a free trade agreement with Ukraine to provide financial assistance, but whether we think that's triggered this conflict in the first place, but watch Moldova, watch the Balkans. This will be very important how Europe manages that. I think it's very, very significant because, you know, that's, but they are talking about troops stationed in the Baltics, which for me was quite extraordinary. I think violates a lot of prior agreements.
Okay, this is back to the movement towards the right by most of Europe's political parties. Is it only immigration that has empowered that? Has the economy also had an effect on the rightward tilt? And finally, is this going to continue? Is it going to get worse? Or are there going to be more and more extreme right parties in Europe?
Right-wing parties. The youth are voting for anti-austerity left parties. So if you look at what's happening in certain countries, you know, you're looking at Italy, you're looking at Spain, you're looking at Portugal, there's a reaction to that austerity and they're voting for left parties. We are seeing the emergence of right-wing parties across Europe. Some of them are very old and they've been around a long time. The Front National in France has been around for decades. And if you look, the problem that we face in Europe is there are two kinds of protest parties. You have these sort of anti-austerity parties, which are in response to the current crisis. But you have two kinds of other parties. One, and they get conflated. One is right-wing parties, which do have an anti-immigration, but increasingly an anti-EU rhetoric, and a wanting to bring back nationalism and national power. And so you have that notwithstanding, and sometimes anti-globalization. And a lot of these parties go back to historical myths. They want to talk about the past and some mythical past that they seem to think about. Austria, Finland have all seen these kind of political parties. But then we also have a different kind of protest party, and that's secessionist parties. Catalonia, Corsica, Scotland, Wales. They're not seeking the same thing. And they happen to actually like the EU, and they want to remain part of the EU. So you've got contradictory tensions amongst the party system. Some of these parties will be flash parties. They'll come and they'll go. Some of them will be part of government. Being part of government is much harder. Ask the Austrians, ask the Italians. Once you become part of government, it's a lot harder to be the anti-establishment party.
Okay, this is kind of a related question, and that is about the illiberal democracy in Hungary. Do you see more moves towards an illiberal form of democracy outside of Hungary and in other, perhaps, as you said, Romania, Bulgaria? I mean, what's going to happen there?
I picked Hungary because that's the one that has generated the most attention. Personally, taking Bulgaria and Romania into the EU as quickly as they did, knowing the problems on the ground in terms of corruption, rule of law, good governance, is a mistake they will not repeat, which is why it's more difficult now for countries like Turkey, Serbia, and others. They will not take an ethnic conflict now into the EU, given Cyprus and their lack of resolution. I think that Hungary is the best case. Most of these countries, including Bulgaria and Romania, have had competitive party elections since the collapse of communism. And that is the definition of democracy. Whether you like the outcome or not, that's important. But in Hungary's case, there's been a lot of irredentism, a lot of talking about ethnic nationalism of Hungarians outside of Hungary. And for Romania, that's destabilizing because the ethnic Hungarians in Romania are trying to integrate into Bulgaria and have their own political party and are trying to, and they find it destabilizing. Hungary's done it before. It tried to promote its language as a minority language in other countries where there's a minority. The EU has sanctions. The EU can stop them voting in the EU institutions. It has a new set of sanction mechanisms. It can stop sort of flows of certain amounts of money, but that's peripheral. The really sort of 800-pound gorilla will to exclude it from voting in the European Council under its new mechanisms. But there are concerns about the independence of the judiciary. There are concerns about freedom of the press. This is an EU state. We can pressure Turkey, but that's not an EU state. This is one that's a member state, and it's different. And so Orbán seems to not really care very much about all of these veiled threats. So it is a concern for Europeans about the sort of surge of illiberal democracy. We don't see it. Hungary's probably an isolated case, I hope, but we do have problems in Bulgaria and Romania.
All right. There's a specific question here, which I think you've already answered, but I'll ask it anyway. Will Turkey become an EU member?
Turkey, you know, I mentioned this last night. One of the things that's forgotten is the two countries that recognized the EU as a legitimate actor in the 1950s was Turkey and Greece. They were the first two to give it sort of diplomatic recognition. And the EU signed the Ankara and the Athens Agreement, fairly identical agreements with both sides. And it gave an implicit membership promise, which Ankara always brings up. As a result of that, you know, in some ways, Greece did the wrong, you know, Greece took advantage, even though it had a variety of, you know, illiberal regimes, but it put its opportunity on the table early on in in the late 70s, and they took advantage of that democratic period and they got on board. They promised they would not block Turkish enlargement at the time, but obviously once you're in the club, you can do anything you want. So Turkey is a very difficult case. It's not an exceptional case. Every state is treated as an asymmetrical partner. You want to get in, you play by our rules, our laws, our acquis. And the problem is when you joined in 60, you know, when you applied as Britain in 61, you only had a few pieces of legislation and commitments. When you try and apply in 2014, there are thousands of commitments that you have to do, much more than trade. This is now about asylum, immigration, counterterrorism, European extradition warrants, central bank independence, separation of civil-military relations. What we expect now is much higher. But Turkey, despite no go on the negotiations right now, domestically is still implementing reforms to meet that European acquis and legislation. So it is, by its own volition, trying to meet European legal standards. What it's scared to death about is the trade and investment partnership between the US and EU, because it will be the major victim of that. It's required under a customs union to accept the agreement. So it's scared about that economically.
We've got another question about a specific country, and I think this could be expanded, but wouldn't Spain, for example, be better off economically withdrawing from the Eurozone? And it may not be the only one.
The Brit in me tells me, I told you so, but the Irish in me feels somewhat different. I think that, you know, this is historically the only... This is the only currency union that has never had a fiscal union. So it was an anomaly from the very beginning. So what we did is create a European currency union and left the nation states to do fiscal policy. Now we're realizing our mistake and we're trying to improve the make the EU do more in terms of macroeconomic fiscal policy. Should Spain leave? That's more difficult now, because then you would be pegging your own currency against the euro, and then you would have speculation. So you're almost tied to the German mast now, because it's Germany that sets the tone. So I think that, but what we are doing is realizing our mistakes. But the amount of money that has been poured in, as the European Central Bank is now the lender of last resort. So the amount of money that has been poured into Greece, to Spain, and to others is enormous. The country that I'm sorriest for is not Spain. Even though they've had a lot, you know, you don't get money from the IMF and the EU without ties. Do your austerity program. You don't get a free lunch. But so I think that the country I feel most sorry for and never talked about is my home country of Ireland. When that debt crisis came on, they went cap in hand to the IMF and the EU, and nobody in Europe could believe it. They promised to pay all of those creditors the dollar on the dollar. And that money, that cost of, you know, paying British finance, British banks, and bailing them out, the Irish government said, we will do one for one. They will not take a haircut. Everywhere else in Greece, in Cyprus, everywhere else, investors took a haircut. Whether they were Russian or European, they took a haircut. The Irish, as the first casualty, refused. Ask the Irish taxpayer in 5 years how they feel about that, and it may be a different story.
Okay, we've got time for one more, and we'll go back to the United States on this one. How do Europeans view the corporate lobbying by Americans to influence EU trade policies?
First of all, it's not just corporate lobbying. Since the single market in the 80s, American law firms have proliferated in Brussels. The interesting thing under European law is it's different than the United States. So law firms can offer practices and consulting and things that they're not allowed to and have to separate in the United States. So it's a very, very good business environment for them. One of the interesting things about TTIP, for the first time, US business and European, particularly trade federations, pharmaceuticals, cars that really want this, have come up with common approaches, common memos, and common perspectives. So that's part of the bargain. But be careful, because if you underestimate European institutions, particularly the Court of Justice or the antitrust area, if you underestimate, you know, they do bite. Google and the right to be forgotten has just come out from the European Court of Justice, and they're scrambling to comply with that. If you ask people about mergers and acquisitions, American global mergers and acquisitions, or you ask Boeing, the EU antitrust law has bite. So do not underestimate those. But corporate lobbying, le lobbying, as the French call it, the British were there in the beginning. The Americans figured it out. One of the things, I grew up in Britain as well as Ireland, and one of the notes I will make at the end is that I grew up and my father had a car, and it was a Vauxhall Ford. It had a big, big company in my home area. And American multinationals understood the concept of a single market in the 50s. Multinational investment in the 50s surged into Europe. And they treated the European market in terms of distribution, sales, manufacturing as a single market, whereas European companies treated them as nationally federal companies. So they understood the power of a single market early on. And I never realized that Vauxhall Ford was actually an American car. I just assumed it was British. So from that point of view, le lobbying is much more difficult to accept in France, but it's part and parcel. The most second lobbyist place outside of Washington is Brussels.
Actually, I'm glad to hear that. I thought we were the only ones. Michelle, I think you're the first Irish citizen we've ever had here, and it's been great to hear you. It's been terrific to hear your views, and we want to reward you with a very famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug.
Office. Thank you. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Which you can have at the American University, but I hope you take it on your next trip to Ireland as well.
I will. Thank you. And as they say, slanta.